I want to welcome you to the Retro Rogues Live podcast. This is a segment from last week's live video show. You can find either one of the live video shows on either Thursday at 7 p.m. or Sundays at 12:05. And now, on with the show. I want to welcome you to the Retro Rogues Live. Please pay attention to our warning graphic. It states that the Retro Rogues Live show is intended for an adult audience and not intended for children under the age of 13. Parental discretion is advised. Again, I want to welcome you to our show. My name is Dave Beatty. I am one of your hosts for nearly the last 3 years. I've been a professional illustrator, graphic designer. Worked on a lot of fun things. Some people's heroes, such as Batman Incorporated, Justice League of America, and even Superboy and the Legion of Superheroes. But enough about that. I want to welcome back my co-host. This is Mr. Eric Alexander. Eric, please tell the folks, hopefully watching or listening at home, some of the fun things you have worked on as a creative professional.
Yes, hello, everybody. I'm Eric Alexander, also known as Bass God 14. That's Bass God 14, not Bass God. That's Bass God like a bass guitar. And I am the chief financial officer of Bad Bob Productions, which is currently involved with the filming of a film over in California called Staycation. In fact, I think they just did some filming yesterday out there.
Very cool. And on today's show, we're going to be talking about the Soviet era television version of Lord of the Rings. I can't say the name. Kuranitelli. Anyhow, that's my best guess. I don't know how to say the name. But this is from 1991, I believe. If you're curious to check it out, you can actually go watch it over on YouTube. That's right, YouTube. Now, the thing that's interesting about this, just real quick, is we're going to be doing a Rogues retrospective. Now, the way a Rogues retrospective works is we are going to talk about... Well, this will be interesting because I think we just recently heard about it. We're going to talk about how we first heard about the film. We're going to talk about how we first... I guess we're just going to talk about the film today because this is not something that Eric and I have really a lot of familiarity with it. So we're just going to talk about this unusual film. And then after that, we're going to get into a little bit of pop culture news and possibly even a little bit of streaming wars. So let's just go ahead and start off at the top.
Well, Dave, let's. I think you're rushing a little bit right now. So let's just take a breath, relax. Hey, it's a special day, right, today? As Hollywood Jackson mentions, it's Father's Day. He says happy Father's Day to both myself and to Dave. I do want to acknowledge this day. It's a special day. But for some of us, it's also a tough day. This is, for instance, my first day my first Father's Day without my father, who recently passed back in August. So I do want to give a special shout out to those of you that are experiencing the same thing, because it is a little bit bittersweet, you know, on Father's Day if your dad's no longer with you. So if your dad is still with you, I would definitely advise you to go over and say, happy Father's Day, love you, Dad, call him, write him something. Because again, there's a lot of us that no longer have a father, unfortunately. So I do want to acknowledge that day. It's a special day. And this is also a time where maybe you and your father can sit down and watch this movie we're going to talk about after Dave and I review it today, because that's kind of the point of what we do here on Sundays, is that it's like a Sunday matinee. So if you want to, after you're done, this film is available on YouTube. If you haven't seen it, you can go check it out. You know, have a little Sunday matinee with your dad. Matthew Reed is also in the house, and he says positive thoughts and energy sending your way, Eric. And Matthew, same to you, because I know actually Matthew's been struggling with some health issues and things like that. So same right back at you, man.
So, sorry if I was rushing a little bit. I'm always trying to get the intro in really quick, hopefully before people decide to leave.
And there you go.
I might have got a little overzealous because I flubbed it, because I'm supposed to start off by talking about what we're going to talk about today and then actually do the introductions. But I always get that wrong. Anyhow, all right. Well, I guess we should just go ahead and talk about this unusual film. Now, to start off with, you have to watch the film subtitled. Okay, on YouTube. And it's interesting because when the film first starts off, the subtitles actually say The Keepers. Did you notice that, Eric?
Yes, because as I understand it, and I'm going to do my best, Kuranitelli is Russian for Keepers. That's what the film is actually called.
And it's interesting because this film, I don't... where do you start with this film? All right, so according to some news articles I read, basically, I guess it was
Leningrad. Well, we can still talk about how we first heard about it. Mine's
real quick. Eric mentioned it. He said, hey, did you hear about this crazy Soviet Lord of the Rings? You want to talk about it on the show? That was it. That's how I heard, first heard about it. How did you first hear about it, Eric?
Well, I did first hear about it, I think, when it first started to break, which was only about 2 months ago. So by internet standards, yes, this is old news, but this is actually something that was unearthed fairly recently. It was thought to be lost. So the background of this film is it did come out literally like in the last days of the Soviet Union, because the Soviet Union fell like in December of 91. This came out April. So literally, this is like one of the last gasps of the Soviet Union. And it's kind of appropriate in some interesting ways after watching the film. But yeah, so apparently the film was a television special that was basically on the like the Leningrad's, you know, version of NBC, if you will, or whatever. It was made there locally. So my understanding is it wasn't even necessarily broadcast nationally in the Soviet Union. It was something that was done by a television station in Leningrad, which of course now is St. Petersburg. Back then it was still the Soviet Union, so it was still called Leningrad. And then the film was thought to be lost, much like, for instance, a lot of classic Doctor Who episodes, you know, like the BBC, they're notorious for that kind of thing, where they would maybe take a tape and they would actually, to save money, they would actually tape over an old episode when they made a new episode. And my guess is that the production quality, you know, the production facilities were probably very similar over there in Leningrad at the time, so that people kind of just assumed this thing had disappeared. And just 2 months ago or so, it was unearthed. And the successor of that that Soviet era television station apparently found a copy and then posted it on the internet. And then everybody else started posting it on the internet because it has gotten quite a lot of buzz. I know that there's actually some major news outlets that have discussed this film because it's actually such a unique thing.
What you're saying is because I did a little bit of research into the film, and that's basically what I heard too, that it had been on Leningrad TV. And then again, like you said, they just uploaded it basically for people to watch. So YouTube's going to be where you want to go, hopefully after the show, and check out this very unusual, we'll use that term, unusual film.
Well, the funny thing is, you know, obviously the actual real name of the film is hard for us to pronounce because neither Dave or I have a background in Russian or anything like that. But if you put in the Soviet Lord of the Rings, you put it into Google, you put it into YouTube, you'll find this movie right away. Right away, it'll pop up. That's why I have that in the banner below. It's in quotes, the Soviet Lord of the Rings, because that is a really easy way to find this film and to find reviews of it as well.
Yeah, it's you know, it's interesting that you mentioned the old Doctor Who, because it definitely looks like it was, you know, shot on kind of like a small sort of, you know, soundstage, as it were. So I guess where to begin?
We have a question in the Rogues Gallery from Hollywood Jackson. He's asking, what's going on behind you, Dave?
Oh,
it's like foil on the wall. You got a green screen going?
You don't like my cave background that I set up here for the show? So yeah, actually, this is the first time putting up my green screen. I set it up literally right before the show, and it's like this show. It's kind of the movie we're talking about. It's there, but if you look close enough, you can see it's not really, you know, that well executed, but it's there nonetheless. So I thought it would be funny to kind of play with this. Originally, I was going to
dress
up.
You're in the minds of Moria, Dave. You are in the minds of Moria.
I was going to like dress up with an outfit and, you know, and do the whole, you know, welcome to the road, do the accent, you know, welcome comrade and all this other stuff. And and then the more I thought about it, I said, that's maybe a little bit too much for me to try and hold for the entire show. So I decided not to go that far. But yes, I do have a faux cave background in honor of our very unusual selection for today. So a little to your left. The problem is Hollywood, what you can't see is that I was already doing that. Eric has literally been watching on camera while I've been struggling to set this thing up. we didn't get to do our usual talk show prep because I was back here, and he's like, what's that sound? Sounds like you do a lot of manual labor, man. So it's like, yes, I am. But yeah, it's funny because I kept trying to frame it a little bit better, but I feel like that's I don't know. We're gonna.
I think
let
the
go,
ring
everybody.
Helps. That's what I was trying to tell Dave. At least the ring helps, which right. Dave does those graphics, which I think came out really well. In fact, if I take the banner down real quick, you can see, you know, what we've got going here. Dave did all that. So we've got scenes, you know, from the film itself. He did a really great job on that. So.
Yeah, and it I was able to put it together relatively quickly too, because it doesn't have to look that great.
You have
it's
to consider
kind of there
to consider the source material, right?
So. Right. All right, so let's now zoom in. Haha. Yeah, the only problem again too, it's like I'm using the camera that's actually on my laptop, so I don't have an external camera. If I had an external camera, I could do that, but I do not have that technical capability. The next time I use a green screen, it'll be better figured out. And then I know Eric knows the reason why I bought the green screen. The original idea was, well, you know what? I'm not going to tell you because one day I'm just going to do it. So we're not going to spoil it. But anyhow, I did buy the green screen for a very specific purpose. But anyhow, enough about that. So let's... I guess let's just start at the beginning with our initial impressions of the film. Now, when you watch it on YouTube, it's in two parts. It's a part one and a part two. If you're familiar with the Lord of the Rings story, and there's going to be spoilers, so everyone bear in mind. But if you're familiar with the Lord of the Rings story, it starts with a narrator. And kind of goes from the beginning with Bilbo and you know, the birthday party and the whole thing, and then leaves off. I'm trying to remember exactly where it. Anyhow, it.
Mike Wolf says spoiler risky. Oh, I can't say it. Sorry.
Spoiler ski.
There you go, comrade.
Yeah. Anyhow, it's. I can't remember exactly where it ends off. I can't remember if it leaves off where they meet Galadriel or right before they meet Galadriel. Anyhow, or is it at
the end?
Talking
about the first part?
Yeah, the first part. Because I think it would just talk about in two parts, like our initial impressions of part one and part two. I guess we just talk about it in general. There's so much crazy stuff. Let's just do our overall impressions.
We should mention that it's apparently that's the way it was broadcast, because there is an actual graphic at the end of the first part that says end of part one. So apparently the way it was broadcast originally in two parts. It could easily be edited into one, I think. I mean, there would be no problem doing that. But I think they were preserving the way that it was actually broadcast.
Yes. So I can't remember exactly where it leaves off. We'll talk about let's just do our initial overall impressions, and then we can just start like peeling the layers off. Shall we?
There we go.
Why don't you go ahead and start your initial impressions, Eric, and then I'll give you mine.
Well, the initial impression, of course, is that you almost immediately you ask yourself, what is it that I'm watching here exactly? If you, I guess, you're not used to Soviet television, which I have nothing. I literally have nothing to compare this to, because I don't think I've ever seen a Soviet television program. You know, a Soviet era. And I just think it's so amazing that this really is a historical time capsule, because literally this is the last days of the Soviet Union when this film came out. You know, like I said, it came out in April. By December, the Soviet Union was gone. So it's really, really interesting. It kind of encapsulates a certain time in the history of the Soviet Union and all the constituent parts of that country at the time. What I thought was really interesting to me almost right off the bat was, you know, I kind of expected, you know, low production values, you know, like we're kind of, I was kind of comparing it to like maybe early Doctor Who or something like that. Right. Which, to put in perspective, what early Doctor Who is like late 50s, early 60s, something like that. This was made in 1991. Okay. So that's kind of interesting when you think about it, just from that perspective. because the production values are very comparable, you know. In fact, I would say Doctor Who, early Doctor Who, probably had better production value than this film does. And what was really interesting to me also is, you know, I'm sitting here thinking this is a Soviet era production, and it's kind of psychedelic. It's kind of the thing that, like, if you partook in certain narcotics, you might enjoy this film quite a bit more, you know, because it's very trippy. You know, there's no other way I can explain it. It's like, it's a very trippy film. And the music, that because they start right out there with that theme. And the funny thing for me was, at first, I didn't have the subtitles on. And I didn't understand how, because the version that I saw said it had English subtitles. So I expected them to just show up. And I started playing it, and I was like, there's no subtitles. So I go to the closed captioning, and it says Russian only. And I'm still confused. So I said, you know what, I'll just try it. So I pressed the Russian closed captioning. It was English. It came out as English. So then I went back to the beginning of the movie, and then I heard the words, the song, to the opening theme song, and they actually fit Lord of the Rings perfectly. The music itself was really weird. And again, like I said, it's almost like kind of psychedelic. But the actual words of the song are actually about the all the power rings, you know, the three rings to the elves, you know, the five rings to the dwarves, the nine rings to the men, and then the one ring to the Dark Lord, you know, that famous stuff. If you're a Lord of the Rings fan, you know exactly what I'm talking about. That sort of classic intro that actually Peter Jackson's version did so well. I thought he did a really good job with that introduction, showing the different races and the rings that they were given and that background. They do it in a song. So almost immediately I started to realize, even though I had this sort of weird impression of the film, I was like, they're covering all the bases, and they're actually covering all the bases fairly well in terms of all the high points of the first book, I should say, which is, you know, The Fellowship of the Ring. It should be mentioned that this movie does not cover the entire Lord of the Rings, trilogy. It only really covers The Fellowship of the Ring, which is also kind of interesting. And it doesn't go any further. There's nothing, from The Two Towers, there's nothing from Return of the King in this particular movie. It's just The Fellowship of the Ring. In fact, when I went to IMDb, IMDb actually lists this as The Fellowship of the Ring with, you know, the Coranatelli kind of listed off to the side. So, you know, you look it up on IMDb, it actually says The Fellowship of the Ring. But Coranatelli apparently means keepers. So it's supposed to be like the keepers of the ring. So they didn't, it's not the fellowship or something like that. That's not what the word apparently means. So I thought that was all really, really interesting. And I have to say, you kind of touched on it a little bit, Dave. One of the things that I thought was really kind of weird was the narrator, because I'm not sure how much purpose the narrator actually fills. You know what I mean? I feel like the story for the most part speaks for itself, and I can see, I guess, because they had limited, you know, obviously limited budget, that it would make sense to have a narrator. But I don't feel the narrator actually filled that purpose. And I don't know. What do you think, Dave?
Well, you know, I kept thinking, it's like, man, I need a star filter and some candles and a pipe. I feel like I could have had a career being this narrator guy. So anyhow, I thought the narrator thing was really weird, because he's always kind of looking at the camera like with this really smoldering kind of thing, and he's got the pipe, and I don't know, it was really weird.
I like when they show him and he doesn't actually say anything. That's what I really appreciated. Like, they just suddenly show him and he's just like,
he's like, yeah, that's, you right.
Know, you know, he's got his little pipe. He's like,
yeah, he's like, that's right.
You know,
it makes me wonder, like, was he some kind of well-known personality or something, you know? Like, I mean, that's all I could think of, because
I think he's one of the only people named in the Wikipedia article where they actually talk about, you know, some of the people that were involved with the production.
Yeah.
I feel like he was one of the few people that actually had, like, his own, you know, like his own Wikipedia article or something like that. That's one thing that stood out to me. I'm trying to confirm that, but
Yeah, it was definitely that was weird. That was so weird. So by the time that I turned the subtitles on when I watched it, and I did watch the first part almost twice, not quite twice, but almost twice. The first time I was watching, I'll be honest, I kind of fell asleep at one point because after work. The second time I watched it, but I did the same thing. It was like for wherever I was watching it from, whether it was my watching it on my phone or watching on the big television in my living room, I kept forgetting I needed to turn the subtitles on. So I wasn't really paying attention to the lyrics of the song, but all I could think of is how unusual this thing is. I feel like it's the music that makes it so psychedelic, is because I feel like that's what actually gives it that feeling, like you're on something. Because there's something to be said for the direction too. All right, so let me talk about my initial, just overall initial impressions of this. All I'm going to say is I'm not going to apologize for having you watch Split Second anymore, Eric. So let's see. Here's the thing. I feel like everyone is in the cast is trying to, like, I feel like people are really trying to make this good with what they have. Okay. Cause I feel like the actors are definitely trying. Okay. The Soviet Burl. Hollywood Jackson says he's the Soviet Burl Lives. That's probably right. So how do I describe this? Cause I don't want to be overly mean, cause that's not my intention to be mean. But it's I don't know. When I was in high school in the 90s, I had some friends that were amateur filmmaker students and wanted to make films and whatever. And we made a bunch of films. Okay. I've never really bothered to put them on YouTube or anything, cause they're not very good. They're actually quite bad. But all I could think of is, like, I think these guys had the same budget I had, which was nothing almost. So that's what I kept thinking, because it was like, I feel like the actors are trying, right? And the music is really unusual, but I don't think the music is necessarily bad. It just, I don't know if it necessarily fits at times. But it's not necessarily a bad choice either when you look at the production as a whole. But I will say this, at one point I laughed so hard that I spit coffee all over the place. Like, I just couldn't help it. It was so bad at times. I couldn't help it. So I feel like the Room now has a contender for the worst movie I've ever seen. Because this thing's you know, that's so bad, it's so bad, it's good. That's kind of where this sits. This sits in that area. So bad, potentially, maybe it's good. So
Hollywood Jackson says the budget was around $200. Laugh out loud. I think if it was $200, Hollywood, there's some guy running around with like $175 in his pocket right now.
I have no idea what the budget was for this. And then, so my wife, Michael, is actually watching part of it, and she's like, why are they looping that shot of the horses over and over again? Because it's clear that, for example, when the ring race show up, it's clear there's only three dudes with three horses, but they keep trying to loop it to make it seem like there's more of them. It was, wow. Yeah, I don't know. I don't, like I said, I don't want to be overly mean, but man, it's weird because I think that's where it is. I mean, what do you think, Eric? I mean, so bad. Maybe it's kind of, we'll say watchable. So bad it's watchable.
I think it really depends on whether you're a Lord of the Rings fan or not. If you're a Lord of the Rings fan, and if you're familiar, if you've actually read the book, which I haven't read the book since like childhood, it's been a very long time. And of course, I'm familiar with the Peter Jackson version. But one thing I want to compare it to for sure that I have in my own collection is the animated Lord of the Rings. Now, what's really interesting about this particular film is almost exactly like Corinatelli, this film basically only covers the first book. It's very incomplete. It gets a little bit into the Two Towers. It definitely gets more into the Two Towers than Carantelli does. But this film was a little bit infamous for that because they ended up using a different studio for Return of the King. It was actually the same studio that made The Hobbit, which I also own. I also own The Hobbit and Return of the King, the animated versions. So this version is very interesting because they deal with a lot of rotoscoping, you know, which people who aren't familiar with that, that's basically where you actually shoot an actor live action and then you trace over him to make the animation. So I do recommend this, by the way. This is actually a really interesting film in my opinion. Even if you end up not liking it, the techniques they use to make it, I think, make it interesting enough on its own. But I definitely compare it to Carantelli because it does only cover basically the first book. So it's kind of incomplete. There's nothing more. You know what I mean? So they never go on with the story in the style that this was made. And in terms of the style of what this was made, other people have said this, but I think it's 100% true. It really does remind you of like a community theater production. You know, it feels like they used wardrobe that they had available already from other productions. Like they didn't necessarily make anything custom, you know, for this particular thing to make it more, you know, more to fit, you know, with what we might think of what the Lord of the Rings looks like or anything like that. It looks like they just kind of reused a lot of stuff that they already had. Heavy use of green screen. Most of this stuff was very obviously shot in the studio. Those horse scenes, I think, being the obvious exception. There's a couple other scenes where you know, clearly they're outside. And of course, you know, it's snowing everywhere because it's you know, probably outside of St. Petersburg, and it's you know, always cold and everything, which I also thought was interesting because I think, as I recall, that at that point in the story, they weren't in a snow location in the book, you know? Yes. It wasn't snowing or anything like that.
Yes, but don't forget the challenge, Eric. Winter is coming.
Yeah, and I thought that was really funny that they kept saying that because, of course, you know, anybody who's a Lord of the Rings fan, they'll know that line. And it kind of gives it a sort of contemporary connection, I think, for a lot of people that are fans of Game of Thrones. That they're like, hey, they kept saying winter is coming. And this is, you know, way before, you know, they adapted Game of Thrones into any kind of a movie or television or anything like that. So it's got a lot of interesting aspects to it. I think for what it is, I actually find it very interesting, personally. The thing that I thought was most interesting, and this is something that a lot of other people have keyed on, is they actually cover a lot more of the book than Peter Jackson did in his version. And the most famous example of that, the one that everybody really talks about, is that Tom Bombadil actually features very prominently in this particular version. Whereas Peter Jackson decided to omit him completely, which was a very controversial decision for fans. I think you're muted, Dave.
Yeah, that's Tom Bombadil right there.
Yeah, that's Tom Bombadil.
The guy with the hat.
Yeah, and it's interesting because one of the things, I have another image here. I have in the background so you can't see it. Sorry about that. But what's interesting also is like one of the weird decisions they did was the actors who play the hobbits aren't particularly tall. They tend to be shorter than the other actors, but they're not like little people, you know, so they tend to be shorter, but not all the time either. Sometimes they tend to be the same size as the quote unquote human characters. Particularly, like I noticed when like they interact with some females, or they're like the same height, you know? So it's funny in that regard, but they depict Tom Bombadil as a giant, and you can see the hobbits are really small. And it made me wonder, well, they could do that. So why didn't they just do that the entire movie? You know what I mean? To show that, you know, the actual stature of the hobbits. That was something that really did stand out to me. Did you notice that, Dave?
I think they didn't do it because they probably just didn't have the budget or the time, or I mean, because here's the thing with this. When you look at it from a storytelling standpoint, they are trying to adapt Fellowship of the Ring to the point that they keep in certain elements like Tom Bombadil that Peter Jackson decided to leave out of his adaptation. So clearly they do care about the source material. And that's what I was saying too. It's like,
which is very surprising to me, being that
yeah.
you wouldn't think the Soviets would give a damn about the source material. You know what I mean?
Exactly. And also too, they are very much, again, trying to make an effort. I feel like from the acting standpoint, like they're definitely trying to bring whatever it is they have to the roles that they've been given. Okay. There's kind of some unconventional choices for us, but then again, we're looking at this from the standpoint of the West. But by the time and those are kind of the positive things. I feel like the actors are trying. Okay. Like I really feel like they're trying to deliver a good performance. You know, and I do feel like that the music is interesting, even though I feel like at times it doesn't fit in my mind this production. Okay. But when you put in the production design and the effects, that's where this thing starts to kind of go off the rails a little bit, but partially because number one, you can tell they did not have the resources to do some of the stuff they were trying to do. So they were just making do with what they had. I mean, you know, I mean, I could get a couple people together with my green screen that's set up back here and shoot a couple people shooting a sword fight with today's technology, you know, and it would look 1,000 times better just because that's where the technology is. You know, when they were doing it, I can't imagine what the limitations were. I know in the late 90s, when I first started doing CGI stuff, we were looking at doing some things and we're hampered by the limits of technology. You know, you can tell that they're trying you know, but it's clear they do not have the resources to really pull this off. But they are trying enough that they are more faithful in some aspects, depending upon how you feel about it, potentially than the Peter Jackson films.
I'll take it a step further, and I will say I do feel this is a much more faithful adaptation of The Fellowship of the Ring than Peter Jackson's version. I will actually go and say that. Because they do hit all the high points, all the stuff that's important to the story, all the stuff that you sort of probably remember if you've read the book. It's all in this adaptation. Obviously the big one that we're talking about is, you know, Tom Bombadil, but everything else is in there as well. You know, they go to the Mines of Moria, but you know, this is another example of why the narrator is kind of superfluous in my mind. The way they used him, because they could have used him to describe what was happening, you know, in the Mines of Moria, because obviously they couldn't show it very well. Their decisions on how to like show the fighting and the battles, it was that stuff is jarring in my opinion. And it doesn't work very well because obviously I think they had a limited budget. I don't know what kind of training these actors had in fight choreography or that kind of thing. They all seem like they're stage actors to me. I don't know if you got that impression, Dave, but to me, they feel like they're stage actors. And it almost feels like a turn of the century film where if you've ever seen those old silent films, everything was staged as if they were on a stage.
Well, and I have a feeling, and I could be wrong, but I wouldn't be surprised to learn that all of the actors in this had been part of maybe a company that was touring doing a theater version of Lord of the Rings. I mean, it might have even been popular, you know, depending upon whatever area that they were primarily known to perform in. But I could see this being a traveling troupe of play, a group of players, for example, you know, actors, you know, touring, you know, performing this. And they went, oh, well, let's make a TV special out of it. You know,
yeah, that's what it looks like. That's definitely what it looks like. But I felt like the narrator could have been used to greater effect, sort of describing some of those parts that they didn't have the budget for. But instead, he just kind of there, you know, and the information he provides really isn't that necessary to advance the story at all.
Along those lines, when they go into the Mines of Moria, for example, like, you know, that's some of the dodgiest effects, I think, actually in the production. And I was kind of surprised they didn't actually have the narrator, you know, actually you know, actually just explain it, you know, like, you know, maybe show them entering the caves, maybe give us a couple of shots and have the narrator tell us what had happened so that our mind's eye could make it make it seem a little bit better. You know what I mean? And then, you know, kind of just give us the high points with the actors. So at least you're not seeing that much of the limited effects that they had. Because man, yeah. I think actually their minds of Moria was when I lost it so bad that I burst out laughing and the coffee came out, because there was a couple shots in there that was just amazingly, amazingly bad. Some of it's actually kind of fits in a weird way. Like, you know, when Boromir is talking about stuff and you see like the little weird characters doing the little slashes with the swords or whatever, and they're talking about what happened in the past or whatever, right? And it's like, it's a little weird, but by the time you get to that scene, you're kind of along for the ride, so you're kind of okay with it. But it's when they're running directly at the camera that it's kind of starts to lose its footing a little bit in my mind, with the effects anyway.
Yeah, there's some questionable decisions that they made with the choreography for sure. James is in the house and he says, just dropping in to say hi and shout out to all the dads out there. I'm getting ready for our family dinner, or third breakfast, if you will. And we appreciate you stopping by, James, and happy Father's Day to you as well. One of the things that I do like is that a lot of that spirit is actually still in this film. Like, the hobbits constantly want to eat. They clearly understood the source material. They clearly understood it, and they clearly, in my mind, were trying to do a good job of faithfully adapting this story to the screen. Again, I will actually say it, much more so, I think, than Peter Jackson. Now, Peter Jackson's argument essentially is that he wanted to tell a better story on screen. Okay, not that he's telling a better story, period. What he's trying to say, as I understand it, to paraphrase him, was that he made decisions because he wanted to advance the story, right? And the way you structure a story on screen is often very different than the way you will structure it in a book, right? That's, I think, fairly obvious. But again, if you're a Lord of the Rings fan, if you've actually read, The Fellowship of the Ring, I think that there's a lot that you could appreciate in this in terms of the effort that they went through to try to hit all those high points that, again, Peter Jackson did not.
Yeah, and that's kind of the thing. Like I said, I that's why I have the feeling that the actors in this, I feel like that they probably were doing a theatrical production of Lord of the Rings already. At least that's my belief. Because it fits everything, you know. Even if you look at the choreography, to be honest, it does look like sort of like the limited sort of choreography that they would do potentially on a stage, because you can't get overly flowery unless you're super prepared or you have a lot of time to rehearse, or, you know, you're used to doing several different setups, you know, so that you're moving the camera enough that you can get enough coverage that even though you have cuts, you know what I mean? It's not obvious. It seems seamless, right? And when you look at the choreography, it looks like the limited type stuff that someone would probably do, you know, in a live production, you know, on a theater stage.
There's literally a shot, I think it's of Boromir who was he with? Not Bilbo, but I'm having an issue with remembering all the character's name.
You're talking about Frodo?
With Frodo, okay. So there's actually like a scene where they're talking to each other, and the way it's actually framed by the camera, they're talking directly to the camera, and the actors are standing right next to each other. They're literally standing right next to each other, because in a lot of the scenes, you can tell the actors weren't interacting with anybody. Like when they're being chased by the, you know, by the, where they're being chased by the Dark Lords, you know, the race, basically, you know, you can tell like there's scenes where they're supposed to be interacting with them. They're not actually interacting with anybody. You know, they're just talking to the camera, because one scene's literally in a studio. the next scene is obviously on some location somewhere outside. And they just cut it together. There's a lot of editing done in this. But I just thought it was funny because they had that one, that at least one scene like that, and there were probably others. That's just the one that I caught. So I only seen it once, where literally the actors are standing right next to each other, and the way they talk directly to the camera instead of having like the two of them talking to each other like you would do, you know, in a normal production. So the filming technique seemed like very archaic. And again, if you're familiar with these like very, very old silent films, like basically stuff that was before Birth of a Nation, you know, which is a controversial film, but basically it established like cinematography as we know it. Those very early silent films, they literally looked like they did a stage production and just filmed it. Camera doesn't move or anything like that. They just set it up like on a tripod and they just filmed the actors doing their thing as if it was a stage production and tried to get as much of the action in as they possibly could. And it was only later that they started to develop these techniques of, you know, focusing in on a certain actor, and they figured out which side they were supposed to be on when two characters are having a conversation and they're going back and forth, all those different things. Those techniques are like completely absent from this production that was made in 1991. And I know, you know, I've seen bits and pieces of other like movies that, you know, of Russian films and things like that, where the cinematography is done very, very well and it's top notch and it competes with anything that's been done in the West. But in this particular production, they just didn't do that. They just felt like didn't even know how to do that. Like that wasn't something in their mind that they had been trained to do.
Yeah. And I can totally see that. And also too, you can tell that they're definitely really limited by the potentially the camera equipment and such that they were shooting as well. Because there's quite a few scenes where they're kind of crowding in frame. And you can tell it's because they're trying to figure out how to handle the transition or show where everybody is, and they're crowding all these characters into the frame, and it looks really awkward and strange. But I really honestly had the feeling that, you know, we have no idea who might have directed this, but I wouldn't be surprised if your director again was someone who probably had a lot of experience with theater, but maybe had not ever actually shot anything, you know, like this. And if they were using some of those old school TV cameras, this is kind of weird because I can't imagine this being live, but if they were shooting this using the old school TV cameras and like the weatherman's green screen, you know, like on a small TV sound stage, you know, with local like players, I really think that's probably what, you know, what they were dealing with. At least that's my initial feel, because that's what it feels like. So
it's exactly what it feels like to me as well. It's like my local TV station decided to do a production of Lord of the Rings, and you know they have a studio, right, and they have green screens like Dave was mentioning, where they have like, you know, they have the green screen they use for the weather person, and they just decide that they're going to do a film there. You know, they maybe have a sound stage that's somewhat empty that they can put sets in. And they just go for it. That's kind of what this thing feels like. It really does.
Yeah, and I it's weird because I don't get the sense of a lot of rehearsals, but everyone seemed to know their material really well, which is just kind of interesting. It just doesn't feel like that they did a lot of, you know what I mean, like just kind of rehearsals, running through things and seeing how the transitions were going to work, because there's some kind of obvious stuff that they probably could have fixed, even with the limited technology and budget and things that they were dealing with. But it really felt like that they really didn't spend really any time in rehearsal either. I don't know if it was, you know, again, it might've been rushed. We don't know, you know, but it's a very unusual production, you know. And I've seen a lot of films that people would consider, you know, bad, and I typically will find merit in the production of you know, whatever that is, you know, based on if you can tell if whether or not there's someone somewhere who cares about what they're doing, you know. And I do feel like that, again, like I said, that I feel like the actors are definitely giving it their all, And like I said, the music is interesting, even though I feel like it's at times out of place. But yeah, I feel like some of the issues they had, maybe if they'd had a little bit, you know, done a couple of rehearsals or a couple of dry runs, I think they might have been able to fix some of this stuff.
Again, I also think that they really could have used the narrator to a much greater effect than they did. The narrator doesn't seem to serve much of a purpose. What I think the idea was that you could use the narrator to fill in some gaps in the story, things that you can't really show on screen. Like, for instance, when Gandalf is, they completely ignore like the scene between, you know, of Gandalf challenging I'm doing terrible with names here. When Gandalf challenges the Balrog, right? That's how you say it, the Balrog.
Yeah, the Balrog. Yeah.
The Balrog. They allude basically that Gandalf obviously like perished protecting them. Basically, that's just basically what they say. But and for obvious reasons, budget reasons, they couldn't show any of that confrontation. But the narrator could have told you what was going on. You know what I mean? The narrator could have popped in all of a sudden and said, you know, Gandalf got separated from, you know, the rest of the fellowship and had to confront a hideous beast or what, you know what I mean? They could have done that, you know, and it seems like maybe that was the intention. They just didn't do it. You know what I mean? They like, for whatever reason, it's just like all of a sudden Gandalf's gone, you know, and, you know, it's left for Strider to kind of explain that he must have perished protecting them. You know what I mean? And he doesn't seem to know what happened, even though, you know, everybody was there when the confrontation occurs in the book. Again, the narrator could have filled in that gap because that's something I'm sure that they had no way in their mind of how can we show this? How can we show this beast or anything like that? It's not in the budget, but you got a narrator. So why not use him? And they don't, you know, they don't. So that I think is that's the one thing I probably will hit it up for more than anything else as far as production value, because it feels like they had a workaround and they just didn't use it. They just didn't use that workaround.
Right. And it's interesting too, when you think about it, probably one of the most iconic moments from Peter Jackson's, you know, Fellowship of the Ring is the, "You shall not pass." Like that's, I feel like that whole scene, you know, with the Balrog and all that, like,
and that's all you could have shown. Iconic. You could have just shown Gandalf saying, "You shall not pass," with the narrator filling in, you know, what was going on, you know, what he was talking to. So you just see him, you know?
Right. And it's interesting too, because I got the feeling that the original thinking with the narrator was framing sequence. And then secondly, I think they were hoping that they could use the narrator as in case of, you know, something doesn't work, and instead of doing like a reshoot, they would just have him talk over it. And that might explain why the use of the narrator is so weird, because maybe they realized they didn't need the narrator as much as they thought they did.
I feel like it's almost reverse, Dave. Like they filmed the narrator scenes first, thinking that they were going to do this. And then later on, they realized, oh, this isn't going to work. This Balrog costume is really terrible. This is just not going to work. And they'd already done all the scenes with the narrator. So they, you know what I mean? Like, to me, it almost feels like it was done the opposite way of how you would think it would be or should be done. And they were just kind of stuck like, okay, because literally that Gandalf scene, it's so strange. It's just like, okay, Gandalf's gone now. Nobody knows what happened to him. You
know? Right. So. Right. Yeah. It's weird. All right. Well, let's go ahead and wrap this up here. With our review, do you have anything else that you want to mention before we kind of give our recommendations or non-recommendations to check out the film?
Just again, you know, it is very interesting, and other people have talked about it, but this is basically your only way to see some version of Tom Bombadil if you like that you know, that character. And I know there's a lot of Lord of the Ring fans that do. It is a very different, he is different from the books, but it is interesting. It's interesting for that alone.
All right. Well, there you go. I'm going to say Hollywood Jackson says he was busy smoking his pipe. Perhaps he was. He was smoking that pipe quite a bit. A lot of smoldering stares in camera with that pipe. Just
literally. Just those scenes of him just not saying a word. They just show him with the pipe.
Little soft gel. Look like star filter action thumbs up, going basically, on. Like,
yeah. I'm still here. I'm still here. I'm not saying anything, but I'm still here.
So strange. All right. So I'm going to say, if you found anything that we're talking about interesting and you want to check it out, the thing that's nice, it's on YouTube. So it's not going to cost you anything to go check it out to see. It is definitely a crazy, almost psychedelic, strange thing. Yet at the same time, relatively faithful, to the actual source material. So I'm going to say, if any of this has interested you at all, you should go search for, again, Soviet Lord of the Rings on YouTube and just check it out for yourself and see how you feel about this unusual production from 1991. What's your recommendation or non-recommendation, Eric?
If you're a Lord of the Rings fan, and especially if you've actually read The Fellowship of the Rings, this is definitely worth your time investment. It's about 2 hours, a little under 2 hours, I think, actually, with both parts. I think it's worth it. You know, the pacing is definitely slow. It's not like a modern movie by any stretch of the imagination. But I think you'll get something out of it. And, you know, I think it does have its own sort of vision, and it did things again that neither Peter Jackson nor this version did. You know, this version, this animated version of Lord of the Rings, that also pretty much just tells the Fellowship of the Ring. This one gets a little bit more into the Two Towers, at least a little bit. There's no Two Towers in this Soviet version. But definitely, if you're a fan and if you have a little bit, you know, of a decent attention span, because I know the way people are today, it seems like everybody has to have everything so fast paced all the time. I think it's worth a watch. I really do. I'm kind of glad that I took the time to watch it.
All right. Well, there you go. Two recommendations. If you find this interesting, or as Eric says, if you're a fan of Lord of the Rings, you owe it to yourself. Again, go to YouTube, search for Soviet Lord of the Rings, and it should come up, and check out this unusual production, Kuranatelli.
A strange right. way to commemorate the last dying days of the Soviet Union.
Very, very true. Very true.
And we made our goal at least with one person. Mike Wolf says, I'm going to watch it later this evening, man. That's the entire point of this show. That's the entire reason why we're doing it on Sundays, you know, in the afternoon. That's what we want to hear, Mike. Thank you very much, because that's the whole point is, it, you know, we do a review and then you watch it later and enjoy the rest of your Sunday. And he says, it seems interesting. Appreciate that, Mike Wolf.
Very true. And, you know, we do a show on Thursday. It's Collector's Corner. But if you do watch it, Mike, you know, maybe come back either on next Thursday, 7 o'clock, or even Sunday again about the same time, 12:05, 12:15, somewhere there. We'll do our next Sunday matinee kind of episode. Please join us and tell us what you thought of this film. I would be very curious to hear your reaction. And I want to encourage everyone too. Please remember, comment from wherever you are. We want to know what you think about the different things that we're talking about, whether we're talking about, you know, this Kuranatelli right here, or a pop culture story, or a streaming wars story. We want to know what you think. So just comment from wherever you are. It doesn't matter if it's YouTube, Twitch, Twitter, wherever. Just comment. We'll put your comments up, just like we just did here for Mike Wolf's. And we want to know what you think. That's what makes this enjoyable and entertaining for all of us.
And Hollywood Jackson mentions it. He says, I always liked B-rated horror films. I wouldn't call this a horror film. I'd not necessarily call it B-rated either. I'm thinking more like Z, but you know, it's still definitely got its charm, much like B-rated horror films, Hollywood. Very much like a B-rated horror film. And Mike Wolf mentions, I'm from the EU. So I don't know what time it will be, but I try to be there Thursday. Mike, we really appreciate that. Thank you very much. And that might be something actually that helps with this time slot. I'm not sure, depending on where you're at, since we're basically doing it from noon. It's noon Pacific time, you know, basically where we're broadcasting from. But that might be one of the reasons that Sunday works out a little better for you, because we usually do our Thursday show at 7 o'clock. Pacific time, 7 p.m. So, you know, in the evening, which I'm not sure what time it is where you're at, but we really appreciate that love and support from across the ocean.
Very cool. Very cool. All right. So let's go ahead and segue over into pop culture news. If that sounds good to you, Eric.
Yeah, that sounds good to me.
All right. Now I'm never going to change the graphics out. Do we want to set up pop culture news or just get into it?
We can just get into it. We're looking at almost an hour right now into the episode. So.
All right. Very cool. Very cool. I'm going to go ahead. Do you want to go first? Or do you want me to go first?
I really don't have anything for pop culture. So it's all okay. You this time, Dave.
All right. Okay. Let me share my screen. Huh. It's not coming up. There it goes. All right. So, all right, so here we go. This is my first, actually, it's probably going to be my only pop culture news story actually today. I felt like there might be enough discussion coming out of this that maybe we only just need the one. All right, so this is coming from the DailyMail.com. And we're getting a little thing there. It's like, hey, do you want to whatever? And I can't even get over to it. All right, anyhow, there's my cursor. I'm getting a little bit of a lag here, everybody, so bear with me. There's too many graphics popping up here on my screen.
Yeah, there's always so many pop-ups on these.
Yeah, it's really, really kills us here. All right, so try and turn that off. All right, so again, this is dailymail.com. This is actually from today, and this is... It says, The Flash, first look. Michael Keaton is spotted on set ahead of donning the Batman suit. And Sasha, I guess it's either Calais or Kale, is hoisted into the air as the heroic Supergirl during filming at St. Paul's Cathedral in London. This is by, Aisha Nazari. Apologies if I'm saying the names wrong. It's not my intention. I thought it'd be fun. I'm not going to really read too much of this, but we're going to mostly just focus on looking at the photos and see what we think. So it says, The Flash star Sasha Kale, Ezra Miller, and Michael Keaton filmed scenes for the much-anticipated DC Comics-based film in London on Sunday. Set for a November 2022 release, Kale, 22, was snapped being hoisted into the air while wearing her Supergirl costume as Miller, 28, stood on the cathedral steps wearing a suit and tie alongside Keaton, 69. I don't know why we're doing all these ages. Helmed by director Andy Muschietti, a sleek Mercedes Maybach, thought to be Keaton's Bruce Wayne's car, was also seen on the film set, with prices for the luxury vehicle starting at, I'm not exactly sure what the, what is that, pounds? 183,000. Okay, 183,000 pounds. Not the weight, those of us in the U.S., that's supposed to be money. All right. So, yeah, I just thought we'd take a look at some of these pictures. Here's Keaton. You can see him there. And then they've got some other kind of cool photos. You know, they've been kind of tweeting stuff out. I think Andy Muschietti's been primarily doing it on Instagram. He's been, you know, promoting pictures of these different, like, there was a look at the Keaton suit with kind of blood spattered on it. There was an updated version of the Flash's costume. And then I think it was just last week he showed off an image actually of the Supergirl costume. And then here we're seeing it right here. I have a feeling that it is going to have a cape at some point, but it'll probably be added in later. It seems like that's what they like to do these days is add the cape and post as a, like an effect shot. But no, yeah, I thought this was kind of interesting. And it's important to remember too, everybody, that this is, again, this is the Flashpoint. So they are basing this is going to be an alternate reality. This is not going to quote unquote be the main DC timeline. So they're going to be playing with the concept of the multiverse, and you're going to see different versions of characters. For example, we know that Ben Affleck's Batman is going to be in this, as well as Keaton's Batman. And then obviously we have a new version of Supergirl here. And I actually think that this Supergirl, I can't remember this character's name, but this is not actually Kara Zor-El. This is someone else. I can't remember if it's Vara Zor-El or whatever, but this is actually a completely different version of Supergirl that was actually introduced in the Superman 10-cent adventure, I think, back in the mid to late 90s. So this is a different Supergirl. This is not Kara. I thought these pictures kind of cool. What do you think, Eric?
Well, I think if this was intentionally leaked, this may not get the response that they're hoping for. Now, I will say Supergirl was trending right before we went on the air, so they are getting some sort of attention. At least I saw that it was trending on some form of Twitter. I never know whether that's a legitimate trend or if that's something that's being promoted, because that does happen. Sometimes they promote things and you can't exactly tell whether it's legitimately trending or if the studio is just paying money to actually advertise that particular thing. I don't think these pictures are particularly flattering. That's just me. I mean, that's my impression. It's kind of funny because I was not familiar with this actress at all. My understanding is she's actually most famous for a soap opera. And I went online. By the way, that's a good picture to illustrate my point. I went online and I looked at some pictures of her where she looks absolutely gorgeous. I don't think the short hair helps. I don't think it works for her. And I'm not sure why we constantly see this. Like, I never understood, you know, like in the, what was it? The Endgame version of Captain Marvel, where Brie Larson had the little pixie cut thing or whatever. I just like that to me doesn't complement her face well at all. She looks much better, in my opinion, with long hair. And I would say the same thing of this actress. But when you see her kind of hoisted up, you know, to me, it just doesn't look very flattering. So I do wonder if these were intentionally leaked or if somebody was able to get these pictures, you know, somehow secretly. I feel like the way that security is on these sets, this stuff has to be intentionally leaked. So I am curious to see what other people are going to start saying and whether this does good for the production or not, because my personal opinion, I'm like, I don't get it. I just don't get it. I've seen pictures of her where she looks much, much better. And I'm not familiar with this actress. I just looked at them online before the show, knowing we're going to talk about this. And she looks much, much better in some of the other pictures that I've seen of her.
Okay. I'm going to try and scroll down so we can see some of the other pictures, but the website is acting up. I'm not sure if it's something with my internet or if it could just be the fact that the Daily Mail doesn't want us to be showing stuff on their website, which is funny because the reason we try to show it on their website is so if you want to go check it out, you'll actually go visit their website, which I always find kind of funny. Otherwise, we would just, you know, screen grab the pictures and
yeah,
you know,
we've talked about that. I think that's what we're going to have to start doing more going forward, is just start screenshotting stuff and just sharing the pictures that way, because we both have this problem. And Dave and I live in different parts of the state with different internet service providers, and we both tend to have issues like this when we're trying to share stuff sometimes. So we do apologize for those technical problems, but that could be part of it, Dave, is they don't even really want us to be sharing this stuff, you know?
Yeah. So. But anyhow, you can see Keaton there. I think Keaton looks pretty cool. I was going to try and show these pictures of this car, but it's definitely acting up. Let me see if I can refresh the page. The car was kind of interesting looking, actually, if I can just get to it. Ah, geez. All right. So let's go ahead. I'm going to stop sharing my screen at this point, and I'm going to see if I can actually find a way to pull these images down. Here real quick. If you don't, just vamping for a few minutes, Eric.
Yeah, I did see that we have a recommendation up there that I thought was interesting. And I'm actually trying to check it out right now just to see where it's available. So I'll go ahead and share the comment here. This is from Michael Wolfs. And he says, I got a recommendation for you both. Google The Admiral 2015 IMDb. And I'm checking it out right now, Mike Wolfs. And I don't think it looks like it's actually available on any streaming platforms or anything like that, unfortunately. We do like to take recommendations on this show for things to review. But from what I'm seeing, I can't find it streaming on anything that I would have any any access to. If you know of something like Wolves, if you know if it's on a particular streaming service like Netflix or something like that, or you know, I think we both have Netflix, we both have Disney Plus. I don't know what other streaming services Dave and I both have. Obviously, we have you know, if it's on any of the free ones, we have access to that. Those, you know, like Tubi, Crackle, Pluto TV, you know, just to name a few, Peacock, depending, you know, whether it's on the free side or the premium side. But we do like to take recommendations for people. And we are looking for recommendations definitely for next Sunday, because we haven't committed to anything as far as what we're going to review for our next film or television review. And I want to put that out there as well. We do review television shows as well. We're trying to stick more to sort of like legacy type content, but that doesn't mean that we won't do something new, especially if you folks out there in the Rogues Gallery ask us to, because we definitely want to take into consideration what our audience would like us to take a look at. And then Mike Wolfs mentions that the movie might be on Amazon Prime as an alternate name. Michael De Ruyter? I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right. I'll definitely check that out, Mike Wolfs, just to see if it's available there. But unfortunately, I don't have Amazon Prime. I believe Dave does, but I don't. So that we'll still definitely do a little bit more research on that, because again, we do like to take people's recommendations for things for us to review. And again, that also includes television shows and things like that. If you want us to take a look, you know, we can definitely look at a couple episodes of a certain television show or something like that. And again, if anybody else has any other recommendations, please let us know. And Dave, I guess, is still...
Okay. All right. Sorry about that. All right. Give me one more second. I'm going to try and get these images to load up here. And we will bring them over. And let's see. Go back to here. And... add to stream. Okay, there you go. All right. So here's one of the pictures they showed of Ezra Miller actually on the set. Obviously, he's in his civilian attire. I thought it was interesting he's wearing a suit, though, because when we saw him in the Justice League movie, didn't strike me as the kind of person who would wear a suit. What do you think, Eric? Do you think he'd be the kind of person who would wear a suit, or do you think this is the...
Well, now that he has a real job, maybe, right? Because wasn't that part of the end of Justice League, was that he finally got... The job that, remember, we kind of commented that doesn't quite make sense, because he's supposed to have the job first and then have the lab accident. That's what gives him the powers. Now he, I guess, was born with the powers or something like that. We don't really know. And he got the job after the fact, the one at the crime lab.
Right, right.
Because that was a major plot point we discussed in our review of the Justice League film, the Snyder Cut.
Right. And then I had one other image I wanted to bring up here real quick. And again, apologies here. I almost sometimes feel like I need three screens. All right, so there's the other one. So this is that car that they mentioned in the news article that they were thinking might actually be, you know, Bruce Wayne's car. And I thought it was pretty interesting looking. I mean, you know, with it being the way it looks, I mean, it almost, to me, reminds me a little bit of either the 89 Batmobile or even the animated Batmobile, because of how stretched it is. I mean, what do you think, Eric?
Yeah, that is a really interesting looking car. Obviously, it's incredibly expensive, as apparently the article mentioned. But yeah, you could definitely see that, you know, sort of existing alongside the Batmobile. I mean, that's a pretty crazy looking car.
It almost kind of reminds me, even though it's not the same thing at all. Did you ever see League of Extraordinary Gentlemen?
Parts. It was a difficult thing to watch for me. So I think there's parts I've seen, and that's about it.
I quite enjoyed League of Extraordinary Gentlemen back in the day, and I actually own it. And it was interesting because in that one, they had that long, stretched out car.
Yeah, I do remember that. I do remember the car.
And the definitely not the same thing at all, but it does kind of remind me of that a little bit because of how stretched out it is. I just thought it's kind of interesting. I thought it'd be worth talking about on Pop Culture News. So there you go. that's it. That's all I wanted to cover. I just thought it'd be fun to talk about some of these photos that have come out for the Flashpoint. I guess we're just going to call it Flashpoint. I don't see why you call it the Flashpoint, but I don't know. There you go. So
I'm definitely more excited about seeing Keaton's Batman come back, hopefully, than I am about Supergirl right now. I'm going to say that.
Well, I am. I guess for me, I'm curious to see the film just in general. But on the flip side of it, I should probably be more saddened or upset about it, simply because of the fact that, judging by everything I'm seeing, very clearly they're not going to be pulling inspiration from Flashpoint, which was one of the DC Comics series. I actually worked on Flashpoint Wonder Woman. And Scott Clark and I did the majority of the Wonder Woman stuff actually for the Flashpoint series. Actually, it was a couple artists who came in behind us who had to finish out kind of what we started because they wanted some Batman Incorporated. It's a long, tortured story. But anyhow, I feel like that I'm unfortunately not. I was kind of hoping I might get to see my name like in the credits somewhere, maybe just a little bit of a mention, you know. You know, if they showed, you know, any version of the Aquaman or the Wonder Woman outfits that we actually designed for Flashpoint, that were part of our contribution anyway. It's like the Flashpoint animated movie. The only thing that remains is this weird sea monster, this Kraken sea monster is the only thing that really remains from what Scott and I did, because they changed it so much for the animated film. It looks like they're doing the same thing for the live action.
Is there a big red flag for you at this point that tells you, you know, that they're going in a different direction?
Well, the thing of it is, the Flashpoint story, while I enjoyed working on it because of the creative freedom that we were given, judging by how everyone's treating the source material, I don't think anyone in a Hollywood capacity considers Flashpoint to be, you know, something that's, you know, that you can't mess with, because everyone changes everything about it. It's like the only thing that's important anymore is just the name Flashpoint. You know, what actually happens in it? I mean, the only thing is Barry will save his mother and everything changes. That's the only thing from Flashpoint it seems like that everyone always holds on to. And then they change everything else from the Flashpoint storyline. So by the time they're done with it, it bears very little resemblance. The animated film is the closest, but even the animated film takes a lot of liberties. So I don't know. I don't know if I call it a red flag, other than it pretty much cements the fact that when I go see the movie in the movie theater, I won't see my name in the end credits with a little thank you. You know, I won't see Scott's name up there as a little thank you, because they're going to probably throw away most of what Scott and I did, you know, just like what they did with the animated film. So
that's disappointing.
Yeah, it is what it is. So anyhow. All right. Do you have anything for Streaming Wars this week?
No, I don't have anything for pop culture or Streaming Wars this week. Okay. Nothing's been on my radar. It seems like it's been kind of slow on news lately.
I haven't seen anything from a Streaming Wars context I felt particularly compelled to talk about on the show, for whatever reason. I have been incredibly busy too, though, so that's no excuse, but there is my excuse. So,
you know, I really wanted to be able to talk about something from E3, and nothing from E3 has been on my radar. I don't know if any other folks out there are gamers, even casual gamers or anything like that, but I felt like E3 was a complete dud this year. I know there's people that are out there kind of shilling and saying, oh, I'm so excited. This is the greatest time ever to be a gamer. And there's nothing that's popped up on my radar. You know, I know there's some highly anticipated games out there, you know, for whatever reason, but I don't feel like it's stuff that's really cutting into the mainstream at all. I think there were people upset about the Guardians of the Galaxy video game. I do think I remember something about that, but that's about all I remember hearing. It just seems like E3 was a huge dud this year. Mike Wolfs mentions, yeah, E3 was quite bad. Laugh out loud. There are no good games. He does say that Halo Infinite might be good, but we will see. And Mike Wolfs, I've never played any of the Halo games because I've never owned an Xbox in any version. My brother actually is a very avid original Xbox collector. He actually has a very substantial collection of original Xbox games. But interestingly enough, he's not a big Halo guy. So I know Halo's a huge franchise, so that's a given. That is a huge franchise that I think even transcends gaming. I think even non-gamers know what Halo is. So I could see that being highly anticipated, but I don't remember even hearing about that. I'm hearing about that from you, Mike. It's really interesting because E3, you know, used to be such a huge event. It's kind of one of those events that I kind of aspired to be able to go to someday, as press or something like that and cover it. But it just doesn't seem like it made much of an impact this time around. And then Hollywood Jackson says, I'm still playing Grand Theft Auto 5. So there you go. There you go. You know, it's funny, Hollywood. The only Grand Theft Auto I have is Grand Theft Auto 3 for the PlayStation 2. That's the only Grand Theft Auto game I own. And I liked it. I mean, I thought it was okay, but I never got beyond Grand Theft Auto 3. And that's another huge franchise. That's another huge, very, very popular franchise out there.
So video game adjacent and also a little bit pop culture-y, Netflix is, well, I guess Streaming Wars too. Netflix did their Geeked Week event or whatever it was, and they were unveiling clips and stuff from upcoming shows. And I would have shown the clip on the show, but as usual, we can't show anything without getting in trouble. So I can't even think about showing it, but they did release one of the first clips, official clips, actually, for the Cuphead Netflix animated series. And they had a scene with King Dice. And King Dice is apparently going to be voiced by Wayne Brady, who a lot of people might be familiar with, either from Let's Make a Deal Now, but a little bit further back, Whose Line Is It Anyway?
That's really cool. Hey, where was that available at? Where can people find that?
You can see it on YouTube. You just search for Cuphead Netflix, or Netflix Cuphead show, and the clip should come up. But yeah, it's the first official clip from the Cuphead animated series that's going to be on Netflix.
That's very, very cool. Yeah, definitely. That's something that I want to check out myself because I do really like the aesthetic of the Cuphead series. I think that they do a great job on the animation. So that's definitely something that I want to check out as well. Mike Wolfs mentions, he says, I got the original Xbox with Halo disc that came with it. If you're a PC gamer, there is a Master Chief collection of Game Pass. I'm assuming that's on Steam. And I don't do a lot of PC gaming, Mike, but I do have Steam. I do have a Steam account. I actually use it mostly for free games. In fact, the reason I got it was actually for the Orville game. Which isn't so much a game as it is, I guess, an experience. I think that's even what it's called, the Orville experience. I've actually wanted to review it on the show, but even though I have it downloaded to my PC, I haven't played it. So that's kind of weird. But I actually do have a Steam account, so maybe I will check something like that out and see what they got Halo-wise. But I don't do a lot of PC gaming, honestly, Mike. I don't. My computer is a little bit underpowered, unfortunately. I've got some issues there. Ironically, I do want to actually get a laptop gaming machine for my film editing for my film company. So something we can have in the field so that we can do data dumps and editing in the field if we need to and things like that. Mike Wolf also mentions, this is, yeah, it used to be really good, but there are so many remakes and no good new ideas. That seems like that's general of all media at this point, right, Mike? It seems like they're all remakes with no good new ideas. We talk about that a lot on this show. You could say it's a bit of a theme on this show. In fact, it's why we tend to focus on the legacy content these days. And we're not focusing so much on new content. It's because that's exactly what's happening. It's all remakes anyway. So why not talk about the original instead of talking about something that's derivative anyway? Hollywood Jackson says, I bought the entire Grand Theft Auto package on Steam. Vice City was my favorite, and I have heard Vice City's a very good game, Hollywood Jackson. You played that one, Dave?
Yes, Vice City is awesome. I love
I've heard
Vice
that's a good
City.
Game. Yeah. I've heard that's a really good game. And Hollywood says that he does play on a PC gamer. But I actually primarily play on my PlayStation 4 these days. That's probably my primary. I have a lot of old consoles. I have a PlayStation 2. I have a PlayStation 3. I've still got my N64. I've still got my original NES. You know what I mean? So I've got quite a few of those classic old consoles, but most of the gaming I do these days is on a PlayStation 4. And then Mike Wolf says, that's a perfect game for a TV show adaptation. And I assume you're are you talking about Halo, Mike? Or are you talking about Grand Theft Auto? I'd be curious which one you're talking about.
I think he's actually talking about Cuphead, because when he made that comment, we were actually discussing the Cuphead clip for the Netflix show that was released. So
even better. So in that case, you're actually going to get it. So that's kind of nice. And then Hollywood says that in regards to Vice City, and I've heard this a billion times, it reminds me of Miami Vice. You know, so it's funny. I have a pitch out there for basically what I call The Odd Couple meets Miami Vice. And I keep trying to get the person that I originally created the idea with me, and sort of some of the little plot points, a synopsis, if you will, as far as we really got. It's basically the log line, which is, you know, Odd Couple meets Miami Vice. And then we had a synopsis for it, and I've never got him to really come back to me and done more on the concept, because I thought it would have been kind of funny, but never got any farther than that, unfortunately. That's just the way it goes sometimes. And then Mike mentions, I love Vice City 2. I played that a lot on my original Xbox, I'm assuming, is OG Xbox. And Hollywood Jackson says, I still have my Commodore 64. Got a MAME project going now, too. So that's funny. You know, it's funny. I never had a Commodore 64. We did have a Commodore PET. That was, I think, the first computer I ever used as a kid. We had a Commodore PET in the house. But one of my best friends had a Commodore 64, and I was so envious of him, because when I was growing up, the Commodore 64 had so many games. I mean, it was crazy. And what's really funny, because, you know, I know they've come out with, like, you know, like a Commodore 64 Mini, and now they even have a Commodore 64 that's full size with a working keyboard that they actually came out with as, like, a flash drive and stuff. But, you know, what's funny is, you know, there were so many licensed games, and there's like no legal way to get those anymore. Like, I know people will do like the, you know, they'll do the pirated stuff, but it's like there were so many licensed games. Like, they had a G.I. Joe game. They had a V game. They had so many crazy licensed games. And like, now those are like almost kind of lost forever, unless, you know, you get the pirated versions that are out there, you know, on the internet.
Well, that's like the my brother and I love the stand-up four-player Spider-Man arcade. It was like a scrolling game. Your character you could pick was like Spider-Man, Black Cat, Hawkeye, and Namor the Submariner. And my brother would typically play as Spider-Man, and I would always play as Namor the Submariner. And I love that game. And that's a game that, unless you get, like, I think it's a game emulation or something on a PC, or you have someone build you like a arcade cabinet or whatever and actually install it into that system, that's something that's just being kind of like forgotten as well.
Yeah, licensed games are a big problem. Licensed games are always a big problem. So it's kind of, you know, in a way you can understand how that works, because you're talking about multiple people basically owning the IP. That happens with films and television shows sometimes too, you know. So it's a weird thing, and I wish they would figure it out, because it's not making them a dime right now, right? And people are pirating all over the place. Why not get it on some sort of an e-store, you know, whether that be for PlayStation, whether that be for Nintendo, or all of them, all the above, Xbox, you know what I mean? Steam, you know, at least then they can make something off of it. But, you know, obviously I don't get to make those decisions. And Mike does clarify that he was talking about Cuphead. It was a hand-drawn game, I think. So it makes a lot of sense to make it into a TV show, since it doesn't look like a weird 3D game adaption to a realistic setting. It is the same. Definitely, Mike, I totally agree with you. It's got that very classic animated look that harkens back to, you know, like the original Disney cartoons and things like that, you know, but very, very, very classic look that definitely, which I think transfer very, very well into an animated series.
And the clip is really great. It's got that, you know, classic 30s era type music. The way that the setting and everything is set up in the clip is good. And it really does feel like very much like a Fleischer Brothers, you know, cartoon, which is where they pull a lot of their inspiration from. So,
yeah, that's very, very cool. Yeah, I definitely wish we could show that, but it seems like every time we try to show a video, we get a copyright strike.
Eventually, we may be able to show something from Cuphead on this show and not get in trouble. Maybe down the road.
The funny thing is, I bet you we still would. That's how stupid it is with us sometimes. It's like, even if we have the rights to something, they'll go after us, you know? So it's like, it's crazy. YouTube's algorithms are just insane to me. I'll never understand them. And I think that they're very punitive, especially to smaller channels, because they let a lot of the larger channels literally just get away with murder and do whatever the hell they want. And then they go after small channels that aren't even monetized like ours. And it's like, what? Why? You know, it doesn't make any sense to me. And let's see. Hollywood Jackson says that he's trying to figure out how to transfer all my old disc to a hard drive. Depending on your setup, Hollywood, it could be really easy or it could be very difficult, you know, depending on your original setup, you know, because these days, obviously, you can get a portable hard drive. It's like USB, plug it in, and you could just dump everything on there, you know, depending on what your setup is. If you have an older style PC, that's one of the real problems, right, is if you're into, like, say, like Windows 95 era or DOS games, that can be a little bit challenging sometimes. But they have emulators, right? Even to this day right now, like DOSBox and things like that. I'm aware of that stuff where you can actually still play those games on like a modern PC, which is kind of neat. Hollywood mentions that Bruce Lee was the best Commodore game ever. Not familiar with that one, Hollywood, but again, that makes sense. You know, the licensed games, as I was mentioning. He says the MAME community, the MAME, is trying to save old technology from back in the day. And I am aware of some of those preservation projects that they have out there to like protect gaming, which is actually an issue. I'm aware of the fact that there are a lot of old games that are actually disappearing and that there are people that are heavily involved right now in trying to preserve the legacy of those games. The same thing has happened with film. There are a lot of films, especially from the silent era, that are lost. They're considered lost films generally because the film itself actually disintegrated over time because a lot of this stuff was not preserved well. So it's kind of a similar situation, especially I think with a lot of these independent games. So, and then Mike Wolf said that, is it like 10 seconds for fair use, right? I'm not sure how it works. And that's a good question, Mike. You know, I've heard actually different things as far as what you're referring to, like with a certain amount of time. I do believe that it's less than that. I believe it's more like 3 seconds, because if you'll notice in a lot of like highly edited YouTube videos, they'll take a scene from like a movie or a television show to like emphasize a reaction, and it's just like that, and then it's gone. So I think it's actually even less than that, although there is a fair use, obviously, for review purposes, where you can show more. But what I always think is funny is why is a trailer protected content when a trailer is basically a commercial? It's like, how is that not fair use to have a trailer reaction?
And at the end of the day, Mike, part of the question is, you know, what exactly is considered fair use anymore? Because as Eric said, we show anything, it doesn't matter what the heck it is, we get in trouble for it. Whether we have sound, don't have sound, whether it's a short clip or a long clip or it's a trailer, it doesn't matter what it is. It seems like whenever we show anything, we get in trouble. So apparently, you know, what technically qualifies as fair use based off of quote unquote, you know, YouTube standards or whatever. I don't even know what that is anymore.
The YouTube answer is get a lawyer. That's literally their
there
answer.
There you go.
Their answer is get a lawyer.
Get a lawyer.
Consult with a lawyer. And I'm not even lying to you because I have gotten that notification. We did a whole thing on COPPA or COPPA, however you want to say it, COPPA, basically the Child Online Protection Act or whatever. And we were so infuriated about what YouTube, the lack of direction that YouTube was giving us on all that. That's why we have the little disclaimer at the beginning of the show that this is an adult show and, you know, recommended for over 13, because if you're considered a children's show, you get all sorts of restrictions on YouTube. It's such a mess. And basically their answer to everything is go get a lawyer and consult with a lawyer on this. It's like, yeah. We're going to do that on an unmonetized channel. You're nuts.
Yeah.
As I said, yeah, yes, Mike Wolf, you're right. Yeah, YouTube is quite shady with their rules. And Hollywood mentions now YouTube is blocking music from video games, and Hollywood not. So is Twitch now. They're starting to go after Twitch. In fact, Twitch, I got a notification a couple weeks ago. They got a big notification. Twitch said that basically they were going to be sued, and that they were for music violations. So now Twitch is starting to crack down on that as well. And Twitch is basically built on people doing like game playthroughs, you know, and things like that with the music and all that stuff. And now they're going after them too.
And the algorithm is so strict. Like, for example, like we got hit actually with a copyright flag a little while ago for a video that we put up, or I put up actually on, I think it was on mine, because I have a RetroWorks Live channel on YouTube that we don't really promote, really. It's kind of, I guess, my shadow channel, whatever you want to call it. And I've put a few things on there. I need to put more stuff up on there. But, you know, the thing of it is, one of the ones I received a flag for, they actually said I was illegally using music that I paid for the rights to use. You know, I actually went out and bought the rights to the music so I could use it as the intro segment. And they flagged me for the intro segment. And I had to dispute it in order to get it resolved. And once I showed the documentation, they allowed it to, you know, now be shown. But they had it blocked at one point. And I'm just like, what is this? Like, I went out and paid for the rights to this music to prevent, you know, what I was actually, you know, having to deal with. It's frustrating and it's difficult. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, Hollywood Jack says that's ridiculous. That is how musicians make their money online. You can't make a dime if it gets blocked, you know. Although I don't think they actually took down your video in that case. I don't think that's actually right. They didn't actually take your video down. Did they? They just gave you a flag, right?
No, they had a portion of it somehow blocked. I don't even understand.
They did block it. Oh,
yeah.
I didn't know
that. Yeah. They had a portion of the video actually blocked. It actually had the music in it, which was really weird. And then, you know, I went through, found my documentation, disputed it, put the documentation, you know, in the little chat thing or whatever. And was just like, look, see, like I paid for the rights to use this music. And they went, oh, okay. And then they unblocked the portion of the video.
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay.
And then, I don't know. I don't know what to do about all this stuff. It's so weird because it seems like Eric said, there's other channels that seems like it's kind of okay for them to do it. But whenever we want to review and talk about something, if we use a clip that involves sound or now not even sound, we look at a clip of anything, it seems like we get in trouble. That's why I've been doing more of the static graphics lately, is a way to, you know, kind of, you know, hopefully get away from that. So.
And Mike Wolf's, we do not have a Discord channel. That's something that I've kind of looked into a little bit, but I'll be honest with you, it's not something that I myself have actually gotten into. Have you had much of an experience with Discord, Dave?
No, I mean, I know people who have Discord channels. I haven't even been on anyone's Discord channel, so I'm not exactly sure what it is. It's going to sound really bad. Yeah, but the way people described it, it sounded like it was just some kind of a message board or whatever. So I've had message boards before. You know, Bushytail's had a message board for a very long time.
Now Hollywood says he has one, but he hasn't used it in a while. Reddit, to me, actually, which I have used, that does remind me of a bulletin board. In fact, that's what I feel Reddit is. I feel like Reddit is just a glorified bulletin board. Because I have used Reddit. I don't have my own Reddit, but I've used it. So,
yeah. All right. We're about a little over an hour, 30 minutes. Look at wrapping it up? Or
yeah, I think we're good to go. I appreciate the Rogues Gallery talking as much as you did. So we do enjoy having a good conversation with you folks.
Yeah, we love it when people actually make comments. It's what makes the show hopefully more entertaining for everyone. That's why we encourage people to comment during the live show. And part of the reason sometimes why we pick things like, you know, this particular, you know, Soviet era Lord of the Rings TV production is because we hope that it's something that you will enjoy talking about, even if you're not terribly familiar. But anyhow, that's the whole point, is hopefully to spark a conversation.
Exactly.
All right. Very cool. All right. Well, I want to thank you for hopefully watching or listening to this episode of the Retro Rogues Live. I want to remind you that our next episode will be Thursday at 7 o'clock. That is 7 o'clock. That is Pacific Standard Time. That is our Collector's Corner, where we normally talk about trading cards, comic books, statues, action figures, all of those fun things that we all like to collect. And in addition to that, I want to encourage everyone, please come back next Sunday, around about the same time. Are we thinking 12:05 will be the official start time moving forward, Eric? Or you want to do?
Yeah, that's normally what I put on there.
Okay.
I don't like to say 12 p.m. or sometimes I'll say noon.
You know, right, so. Right. So, yeah, hopefully come back next Sunday, 12:05, and that'll be our next episode here. We've had some recommendations. I actually have a recommendation that someone actually made to me, which is actually to take a look at the 2D Clone Wars cartoons that are actually on Disney Plus. I just haven't had a chance to talk with Eric about it yet.
I like that.
Yeah. So there you go. So we don't know exactly what we'll be doing next, but we should know hopefully soon. And I want to encourage you, please tell people about the show, friends, family, anyone you think might enjoy the show, anyone you think might enjoy coming on here and being part of the conversation, please invite them to check out the Retro Rogues Live. If you're curious to see some of my artwork, as well as see what is oftentimes the thing that occupies a lot of my time, please check out KirbyTees.com. That's KirbyTees.com. That is my t-shirt company on there right now. We have a couple of Retro Rogues Live t-shirts on there, as well as Brains Are Magic by Sarah Aerosmith, and then also the Skelethor t-shirt, which is a basic collaboration between myself and the Janimal. A lot of fun things over there at KirbyTees.com. Please check that out. Please considering purchasing a Retro Rogues Live t-shirt and supporting what we're doing here on the show. We would greatly appreciate your support. Eric, please tell the folks, hopefully watching or listening at home, where they can learn more about you on the interwebs.
Well, I'm most active on Twitter. You can find me there at BaseGod14. That's at BASSGOD14. That's also the official YouTube. That's also the official Twitch. So if you make a comment on either one of those platforms, more likely than not, I'll be the one that's going to be responding to you. So please make your voices heard and your opinions known. And even if you disagree with us, we are always welcome to take on the challenge and engage folks, whether they agree with us or not, because we do allow all different points of view on this show. And we definitely appreciate the folks that tune into the live show. Hollywood Jackson mentions that I used to play MC5 and we had a channel to communicate during gameplay. I assume that's another reference to Discord. And Mike Wolfs mentioned in regards to Discord, it's like a message program. You can put different boards up for chat and some voice channel for your subscribers. Very interesting, Mike. And with that, we're going to go ahead and leave Mike with the last word.
We want to thank you for listening to this episode of the Retro Rogues Live podcast. You can learn more about Eric Alexander and Five the Live Show on either Twitch, YouTube, or Twitter by searching for BaseGod14. That's BASSGOD14 on either YouTube, Twitch, or Twitter. If you are curious about co-host Dave Beatty, you can see some of his art, find social media links, and so much more at his website, DaveBeatty.com. That's DaveBeatty.com. If you enjoyed this episode of the Retro Rogues Live, be sure to like, share, and subscribe.